Welcome to According to Sam, folks. This is episode 190. Thank you guys for listening and tuning in. You know, we've been talking about Ukraine and what's going on in Ukraine, how the war in Ukraine started for the past few weeks. Going to get back into that in this podcast. There's a lot that I still haven't covered. I think that it's really important to cover this stuff in detail because a lot of Americans don't know this stuff that I'm explaining to you and the context that it adds to what you're hearing on television and the media propaganda that you're being bombarded with. And like I've been saying in the past few podcasts that that now that this bill has passed through the Senate, there's going to be a lot of pressure on the Speaker of the House and the House of Representatives to pass this bill, this money, this much needed money for Ukraine. And there's a lot of lies, flat out lies. There's a lot of war propaganda going on. You know, this is what Dwight Eisenhower warned us about in 1960 in his famous farewell address, where he, I mean, that speech is so good, man. We may have to get into that Eisenhower address because there's so much that he says in that address and that pertains to what we're dealing with right now. Right now. And so there's flat out lies going on. There's propaganda and everyone's in on it. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat. They're all telling the same story. They're all demonizing what they call MAGA Republicans and Trump Republicans who, quite frankly, these people are the most informed people about how the war started and what's actually going on there. There's a few on the left as well, but the people that are all gung-ho and saying, we got to get this Ukraine funding going. I can't believe that those MAGA Republicans are doing Putin's bidding. Those are the people who know the least about Ukraine. Those are the people who I wonder if they could find Europe on a map. Let alone find Ukraine on a map. But there, I mean, those are the easiest people to propagandize. And you see it going on. So let's get into this. We're going to get back into this. We're going to start with this guy. And Mitt Romney. Man, I don't want to say what I really want to say about Mitt Romney, because if you're not able to say something nice about someone, it's better just to not say anything at all. And I have nothing nice to say about Mittens Romney. Nothing nice to say. But anyway, he was on CNN the other night explaining why we need to continue funding to Ukraine, why this $95 billion bill that does nothing for the United States of America, why this needs to be passed in the House of Representatives, and the importance of it. And this conversation that Mitt Romney has on CNN the other night is going to guide our discussion on the podcast today. Let's take a listen to Mitt Romney.
If we don't pass aid for Ukraine, then I think Ukraine has a very difficult time preserving their geographic integrity and life. You're going to have a lot of people who lose their life as Russia runs across Ukraine, and that will make it very clear to people.
People are losing their lives right now. People have lost their lives, have been losing their lives for 10 years. People started losing their lives in Maidan during the Maidan coup. People have been losing their lives in the Donbas region over the last 10 years. People have been losing their lives over the last two. What are you talking about, Mitt Romney, that people are going to lose their lives if we don't pass this $60 billion for Ukraine? This is insane. This is why I have nothing nice to say about this guy.
Then I think Ukraine has a very difficult time preserving their geographic integrity and life. You're going to have a lot of people who lose their life as Russia runs across Ukraine. And that will make it very clear to people around the world that you really can't trust America's word, because we made a commitment in 1994 to respect the sovereignty of Ukraine, to help defend the people of Ukraine if they were attacked. And that's
so we made a commitment in 1994 to respect the sovereignty of Ukraine and to help Ukraine if they were attacked.
To respect the sovereignty of Ukraine, to help defend the people of Ukraine if they were attacked.
All right. So what is he talking about? He's talking about the Budapest Memorandum. In 1994, the Budapest Memorandum was agreed on by Bill Clinton. I want you to listen to Ted Cruz here tell you about what the Budapest Memorandum is.
Well, after Ukraine successfully declared independence from the USSR in 1991, the United States signed an agreement called the Budapest Memorandum on Security Assistance. The Budapest Memorandum, under the terms of it, Ukraine agreed to give up its nuclear weapons. Ukraine had the third largest stockpile of nuclear weapons on the face of the planet. America agreed quite reasonably the world would be safer if Ukraine did not have nukes. And the brand new Ukrainian government agreed and gave up their nuclear weapons, making America safer and the world safer. But the Ukrainian government did not do so for nothing. It did so in exchange for explicit assurances that the United States would protect Ukraine's territorial integrity. Let me reiterate that.
So that is the Budapest Memorandum. I want you to listen to a little bit of Bill Clinton here talking about it as well, because the Budapest Memorandum was agreed upon in his administration.
Did not support the agreement President Yeltsin made never to interfere with Ukraine's territorial boundaries. An agreement he made because he wanted Ukraine to give up their nuclear weapons. They were afraid to give them up because they thought that's the only thing that protected them from an expansionist Russia. So he gave them up. Yeltsin's word was good. He kept his word, but he couldn't pass it through the Duma. So when it became convenient
to him, It was non-binding, first of all. The Budapest Memorandum was absolutely non-binding. And no, Yeltsin could not pass it through the Duma.
Yeltsin's word was good. He kept his word, but he couldn't pass it through the Duma. So when it became convenient to him, President Putin broke it and first took Crimea.
All right. So Putin was the first to break the Budapest Memorandum when he took Crimea, is what Bill Clinton said. So that's what Mitt Romney's talking about here when he says that we made a commitment in 1994 that if Ukraine gives up their nuclear weapons, that we would protect their territorial integrity. But it, I mean, doesn't say anything about the CIA staging a coup there with civil society and George Soros. It doesn't say anything about that. Does the Budapest Memorandum say anything about our CIA and our State Department going into Ukraine and staging a coup? And then after we stage a coup and create all of this unrest in Ukraine, then we have to protect their territorial integrity because of something that we caused. It's ridiculous. The Budapest Memorandum was non-binding. And as Bill Clinton says, as you have been told, as many people believe, that the Russian government, that they first violated the Budapest Memorandum when they invaded Crimea. Again, Russia has had a naval base in Crimea since Catherine the Great, going back to the late 18th century. How are they going to invade a place that they have a naval base, which and that they've had for two centuries? It makes no sense, but that's what they want you to believe, that Russia invaded Crimea and that initiated our involvement, because we made an agreement with the Budapest Memorandum in 1994 that we would protect them. So that's how we got involved. But that's not how we got involved. We were involved way before that, long before that. And we were involved in some very dubious ways. Okay, back to Mitt Romney here.
Your life as Russia runs across Ukraine. And that will make it very clear to people around the world that you really can't trust America's word, because we made a commitment in 1994 to respect the sovereignty of Ukraine, to help defend the people of Ukraine if they were attacked. And that's what's happening. And if we walk away from that, they won't trust our word. Europe will say, hey, the United States is not with us. We're not going to be with them if there's something they want to do in the Pacific. For instance, let them deal with China. Let America deal with China and the issues there. So we're strong globally, in part because of our friends.
Our friends.
We have alliances. We always talk about how
our friends, our alliances. Don't forget that. Don't forget our friends, our alliances. Remember what we're going to talk more about Victoria Nuland here in a moment. But at the end of last podcast, we listened to a little bit of the phone call with Victoria Nuland and the ambassador to Ukraine at the time. These are our friends, supposedly, our allies, the EU. This is what she says, Victoria Nuland. F the EU, Mitt Romney. These are our friends that you're talking about. F the EU. Okay? So those are our friends. F the EU.
Globally, in part because of our friends. We have alliances. We always talk about how the Russians and the Chinese don't have the kinds of friends we have. Well, we have friends in part because we stand together. And if we don't stand with our friends, we will lose strength, and that will ultimately come to hurt us.
So you disagree with your colleague, Senator J.D. Vance, who is making the argument that $60 billion more won't fundamentally change Ukraine's stance on the battlefield.
Yeah. This is so good. This is so good. This is so good. This the question and the answer, because J.D. Vance, new senator from Ohio, has said that what difference is it going to make if we give them another $60 billion? How is this $60 billion going to help them on the battlefield to defeat Russia? They're not going to defeat Russia. They're not going to defeat Russia. So why us throwing another $60 billion at this, what is that going to do on the battlefield, is what J.D. Vance has said. And this is the question that she asked Mitt Romney about, and his answer is so good.
Don't stand with our friends, we will lose strength, and that will ultimately come to hurt us.
So you disagree with your colleague, Senator J.D. Vance, who is making the argument that $60 billion more won't fundamentally change Ukraine's stance on the battlefield.
Yeah, that is an interesting point. It just happens to be as accurate as it is irrelevant.
It's as accurate as it is irrelevant. Wow, Mittens. Mittens agrees with J.D. Vance that it's accurate that $60 billion is not going to help them on the battlefield. Absolutely not. $60 billion is not going to help them on the battlefield. So that's the new narrative now. The new narrative is that the $60 billion isn't actually even for Ukraine. And I don't have time to play those clips in this podcast. Maybe we'll play those clips and talk about Eisenhower and the military-industrial complex in the next podcast. Because now the narrative is, and they're all repeating it, that the $60 billion is not for Ukraine, people. It's for us, actually. That we are going to send Ukraine our old weapons, and then we're going to manufacture new weapons. And so it's going to help our economy, passing this $60 billion for Ukraine. Blessed are the peacemakers, folks. I don't care. I don't want my economy to be. I don't care what it does to my economy. You guys have destroyed our real economy. You're not going to get me to buy into an economy that's based on war. I'm sorry. But that's the new narrative now, is that the $60 billion is for us, actually, because it's going to help our economy. I want you to listen to Victoria Nuland here talk about some of the things that $60 billion is going to. So Mitt Romney knows that this isn't even going to the battlefield. This isn't going to help them on the battlefield. He knows that Ukraine is not going to defeat Russia. And that's what he says. It is not only accurate as it is irrelevant. Listen to what he says. It's not only accurate.
That is an interesting point. It just happens to be as accurate as it is irrelevant. All right. It may not change their stance on the battlefield. What it does do is communicate to the entire world.
So he knows that it's not going to change their stance on the battlefield. Listen to some of the stuff.
This supplemental funding that we are asking Congress for will also help Ukraine to fight and enhance its asymmetric military capability, because fighting like World War I trench battle is not going to get them where they need to go. It will also help strengthen their economy. The more air defense you can bring in, the air defense provides bubbles under which the economy can grow, the tax base can grow, people feel safe coming home. So all of this is about the fight today, but it's also about putting Ukraine on a more sustainable footing.
So it's going to go to help their tax base. It's going to go... $60 billion, people, that's a lot of money. It's going to be going a lot of different places. There's going to be a lot of grift going on too. Yeah, you bet. That's why they're in such a hurry to get this money passed. It's a lot of money. So, the money's not going to help them on the battlefield. Even Mitt Romney agrees to that, but listen to why he says that we got to pass it anyway, even though we know it's not going to help them on the battlefield. We know that it's not going to help them win. We need to pass it basically as some type of money laundering, so it goes out of the public treasury to Ukraine, back to our military industrial complex. People, come on.
Fundamentally change Ukraine's stance on the battlefield.
Yeah, that is an interesting point. It just happens to be as accurate as it is irrelevant. All right, it may not change their stance on the battlefield. What it does do is communicate to the entire world that we honor our commitments and we stand with our friends and we will help freedom fighters around the world.
Freedom fighters around the world. And that's the money. That's the money quote right there. We will stand with freedom fighters around the world. And that's the question that I want to get to in this podcast. And we want to talk about who are the freedom fighters in Ukraine. Who are the freedom fighters in Ukraine, people? Who are the freedom fighters in Ukraine? Mittens Romney here says that that's what we do. In America, we stand behind freedom fighters.
Our commitments, okay? And we stand with our friends, and we will help freedom fighters around the world.
We will help freedom fighters around the world. So who are the freedom fighters in Ukraine? Who are the freedom fighters in Ukraine, Victoria Nuland, neocon Victoria Nuland? Who are the freedom fighters in Ukraine? Who are the freedom fighters in Ukraine? Who are the freedom fighters in Ukraine? All right, let's listen to more. We listened to a little bit of this phone call. This is the leaked phone call that Victoria Nuland was having with then ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt. And the phone was tapped. It was leaked. It was most likely done by Russia. But as I was telling you, that George Soros, through his civil society group, is the one who started the Maidan protests. Protesters were mostly just normal, everyday people exercising their right to demonstrate. And they gave cover to the small minority of Nazis that were in their group that were there prepared and equipped for violence. They were facing off with Viktor Yanukovych, who was the president of Ukraine at the time, democratically elected, and his security forces. And again, I like to get you guys thinking about January 6th and protesters showing up to the United States Capitol to protest in a violent protest. And it's really interesting. I was thinking about this, that John McCain and Christopher Murphy went over there while the protest was going on. And they were saying, you know, that we're prepared to sanction, you know, the Yanukovych government if they use any violence. Don't use any violence to clear the protesters. And I was bringing up, I brought up the Bonus Army event that happened in the 1930s in Washington, where we use violence to clear the people from the Capitol. But could you imagine another country telling us that if we had demonstrations like, so remember when Black Lives Matter attacked the White House in, I think it was in either in May or June, right after George Floyd died. For some reason, all the protesters go to the White House, like Trump had killed George Floyd or something. So they're attacking the White House. They're about to burn down St. John's Church that's there in Lafayette Square. And Trump comes out with the National Guard with tear gas and clears Lafayette Square and get all these Black Lives Matter protesters out of there. Could you imagine Russia, France? I mean, could you imagine England saying, I can't believe Donald Trump used violence to clear the protesters. But Yanukovych agreed with John McCain and Christopher Murphy, they were not going to use violence. And they were just standing off, and they had been standing off with these protesters there in the square for weeks. And the CIA hires someone. I'm just going to say it. The CIA hired Ukrainians that they were not hired. They had been working with these Ukrainians because Brennan, we talked about the New York Times article. The article says that these bases have been there since 2016. I guarantee you they had bases there well before 2016. So these provocateurs that I believe and Putin believes and any thinking person who knows anything about this understands that these provocateurs that started shooting at both sides, shooting at the protesters and shooting at the police to get them to shoot at each other, they're the ones who started this war and started this whole conflict. They got the violence started in Euromaidan, which forced Yanukovych to leave. So now Yanukovych leaves. He's, negotiating his ouster at this time when this phone call takes place. He's not left yet, but he's leaving. He's on the verge, and they're talking about, well, once he does leave, who's going to take his place? And Victoria Nuland, F the EU, neocon, working for the Obama administration, she's talking to Jeffrey Pyatt about who's going to go into the new government. We were making the call. The United States government was involved from the absolute beginning. We were meddling in what was going on in that country. They tell you that Ukraine is a sovereign, democratic country. That is not true. We were meddling in that country. Ukraine is a vassal state that we did everything that happened in Ukraine. We're the ones who violated the Budapest Memorandum to get all this stuff started. And I'm going to prove this to you here in a moment. All right, let's listen to this phone call.
What do you think?
I think we're in play. The Klitschko piece is obviously the complicated electron here. especially the announcement of him as deputy prime minister. And you've seen some of my notes on the troubles in the marriage right now. So we're trying to get a read really fast on where he is on this stuff.
You know what? I'm sorry, guys. I'm gonna introduce you to some characters first. Let's introduce you to some characters, and then we'll listen to the phone call, because I want you guys to know who they are talking about when they in this phone call. So Arseniy Yatsenyuk, this is who Victoria Nuland refers to as Yox. He, after the coup, he becomes the interim prime minister. And what you got to understand is that after the coup, the first thing that the Obama administration wanted to do is immediately after the coup, get elections on the calendar so they can have elections, because elections legitimize the coup. So after the coup, we have to have elections as soon as possible. The elections don't happen for a few months later because it took them some time to get the get everything up and running so they can have election. There's some other things that they have to do that they had to do before elections as well, which we'll talk about here in a moment. So before they could have elections and legitimize the coup government, they had to have the interim government that they put in place to kind of stabilize Ukraine so then they can have elections. And that's what Victoria Nuland and Jeffrey Pyatt are talking about in the phone conversation, the interim government. Okay, so Arseniy Yatsenyuk, who she calls Yox in the phone conversation, he becomes the interim prime minister. And she, in the phone call, he is the guy who Victoria Nuland says he should be the new prime minister. And he becomes the new prime minister. Just more evidence that we're controlling all of this. I'm not going to read all of this, but I want you to read this last paragraph here. Expand this a little bit. I don't think I can expand it anymore. I'm going to read it to you. It says, he has played down his Jewish Ukrainian origins, possibly because of the prevalence of anti-Semitism in his party's Western Ukraine heartland. So he's in a political party that has a prevalence of anti-Semitism. Just going to leave that there. This write-up comes from The Guardian. So just tells you a little bit about who he is. He turned down position of prime minister when now ousted Yanukovych offered it to him in January, but accepted the role following the Euromaidan protest victory last month. So he becomes the new prime minister, Arseniy Yatsenyuk. His political party that we were just talking about, the People's Front. People's Front is a nationalist, conservative political party in Ukraine. Okay. So that's who the interim prime minister was, Arseniy Yatsenyuk. Joe Biden, we're going to listen to how Joe Biden gets involved. Joe Biden endorsed Arseniy Yatsenyuk. Obama brings Arseniy Yatsenyuk to the Oval Office, to Washington. So the Obama administration, Victoria Nuland says in the phone call that I think that Yatsenyuk should be prime minister, and then Yatsenyuk becomes prime minister and everyone endorses it. Yatsenyuk. Okay. This guy, Vitaly Klitschko. Klitschko is the current mayor of Kyiv. In the phone call, Jeffrey Pyatt is talking about Klitsch in the beginning, and he says that that Klitsch is going to be in the government. And Victoria Nuland says, no, I don't think Klitsch should be in the government. I think Yox should be the prime minister. And so that's who she's talking about. She's talking about Klitschko here. Klitschko was a boxer. He was part of the Euromaidan protests. So that's Klitschko. And when they say Klitsch, that's who they're talking about. All right, this guy right here, Olli Tonnebuch. So you'll hear Victoria Nuland in the phone call talk about Tonnebuch, and this is the guy who she's talking about. Tonnebuch created this political party called Svoboda. Let's see what he says about Svoboda. During the 1990s, it was accused of neo-Nazism due to the party recruitment of skinhead and usage of Nazi symbols. So that's who this guy, Tonnebuch, is. Tonnebuch is a Nazi. I'm sorry. The guy's a Nazi. All right, so that's who Tonnebuch is. That's right here. Remember this article? John McCain. John McCain went to Ukraine and stood on stage. This is Yahoo News. John McCain went to Ukraine, stood on stage with the man accused of being a anti-Semitic neo-Nazi. John McCain there with Yatsenyuk and Tonnebuch. Okay? All right? Svoboda, that's the political party that Tonnebuch created. This guy's not talked about in the phone call with Victoria Nuland, but you should know who he is. His name is Oleksandr Turchynov. In the interim government, Yatsenyuk becomes the prime minister, and then Turchynov becomes the president. You should know who this guy is. Turchynov. All right? And then the last character I'll introduce you to is Petro Poroshenko. Petro Poroshenko, he becomes the president when they finally do have elections. Petro Poroshenko becomes the first person who is elected president of Ukraine. All right, and he's not in the conversation. So now let's listen to the phone call with Victoria Nuland and Pyatt, and now you know who she's talking about.
What do you think?
I think we're in play. The Klitschko piece is obviously the complicated electron here, especially the announcement of him as deputy prime minister. And you've seen some of my notes on the troubles in the marriage right now. So we're trying to get a read really fast on where he is on this stuff. But I think your argument to him, which you'll need to make, I think that's the next phone call we want to set up, is exactly the one you made to Yats. And I'm glad you sort of put him on the spot on where he fits in this scenario. And I'm very glad he said what he said in response.
Good. So I don't think Klitsch should go into the government. I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I guess.
It's funny because she says, I don't think Klitsch should go into the government, and Klitsch doesn't go into the government. I think it's really interesting that he becomes the mayor of Kiev, because it's like, we got to give this guy something, you know? He was part of the Maidan protests. He helped lead the Maidan protests. You know, we got to give this guy something. And Victoria Nuland saying that he can't go into the government, so we'll make him mayor of Kiev. I think that's interesting.
I don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you think... What, in terms of him not going into the government, just let him sort of stay out and do his political homework and stuff. I'm just thinking, in terms of sort of the process moving ahead, we want to keep the moderate Democrats together. The problem is going to be Tony Boak and his guys. And, you know, I'm sure that's part of what
Tony Boak and his guys
on all of this.
Tony Boak.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tony Boak on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know.
I mean, Tony Boak is a Nazi. So they know these people are Nazis, man. They know these people are Nazis. The entire time they're using them to stage this coup, they know who they are.
The guy, you know, what he needs is Cleach and Tony Boak on the outside. He needs to be talking to them four times a week, you know. I just think Cleach going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay. Good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
My understanding from that call, but you tell me, was that the big three were going into their own meeting and that Yats was going to offer in that context.
I love how she calls them the big three. I love how she calls them the big three. Let me see if I can find a picture here of all three of them together. Oh, look, John McCain, Chris Murphy standing next to him over there. There it is, the big three with Victoria Nuland. Check it out, all four of them together. Victoria Nuland in the center, and the big three are around them. This is Klitschko, Yaks, Tony Boak. The big three with their mama.
the 3+1 conversation or 3+2 with you. Is that not how you understood it?
No, I think that's what he proposed, but I think just knowing the dynamic that's been with them where Klitschko has been the top dog, he's going to take a while to show up for whatever meeting they've got, and he's probably talking to his guys at this point. So I think you reaching out directly to him helps with the personality management among the three, and it gives you also a chance to move fast on all this stuff and put us behind it before they all sit down and he explains why he doesn't like it.
Okay, good. I'm happy. Why don't you reach out to him and see if he wants to talk before or after?
Okay, will do. Thanks.
Okay, I've now written... Oh, one more wrinkle for you, Jeff.
Yeah.
I can't remember if I told you this or if I only told Washington this, that when I talked to Jeff Feltman this morning, he had a new name for the UN guy, Robert Seri. Did I write you that this morning?
Yeah, okay. I saw that.
He's now gotten both Seri and Ban Ki-moon to agree that Seri could come in Monday or Tuesday.
Okay.
So that would be great, I think, to help glue this thing and have the UN help glue it. And, you know, fuck the EU.
So why is she saying F the EU? F the EU to our friends that Mitt Romney says that we're so, obligated to our friends when you have, a lead diplomat in the Obama and Joe Biden administrations saying F the EU. These are her friends. Why is she saying F the EU? Because she's telling Piatt that we're getting the UN involved. The UN is going to help us legitimize this thing. So the EU, I guess they weren't in on it in the beginning. And the EU were putting up roadblocks in the legitimizing of this coup d'etat. But they were going to bring the UN in afterwards, and the UN were going to say that the elections that they had a few months later, that the UN's going to say that those elections were fair, and the UN's going to put the stamp of democracy on them, the stamp of approval that this is a democracy now. So that's why she's saying, screw the EU. If the EU doesn't want to play ball, we'll bring in the UN, and the UN will put the stamp of approval on this. So that's why she's saying that. It's very important.
But, and, you know, fuck the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together because
we've got to do something to make it stick together. So the UN was going to do the job of making it stick together. So that's why she's saying F her friends, F the EU.
Fuck the EU.
No, exactly. And I think we've got to do something to make it stick together, because you can be pretty sure that if it does start to gain altitude, the Russians will be working behind the scenes to try to torpedo it. And it's again, the fact that this call, is out buddy. There right now, I'm still trying to figure out in my mind why Yanukovych did that. But in the meantime, there's a Party of Regions faction meeting going on right now, and I'm sure there's a lively argument going on in that group at this point. But anyway, we could land jelly set up on this one if we move fast. So let me work on Klitschko, and if you can just keep, I think we want to try to get somebody with an international personality to come out here and help to midwife this thing. And then
we got the UN. The UN's going to put the stamp of approval. The only thing we need now is someone to with an international personality. Someone with an international personality, someone who was on the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate for 30 years or however long he was on the Foreign Relations Committee, someone who was vice president, maybe someone with an international personality to come in and midwife this thing, is what he says. And who is that? Who is the person with the international personality? Who is the person with the international personality that we can bring in to midwife this thing? This thing what? What thing? What thing are we midwifing? What thing is he midwifing? This coup d'etat. Someone who can come in to midwife this coup d'etat. And now this guy's president of the United States, and he's saying that you have to borrow another $60 billion so he can dump into this thing that he midwifed. This thing that he midwifed back in 2014.
Some personality to come out here and help to midwife this thing. And then the other issue is some kind of outreach to Yanukovych, but we probably regroup on that tomorrow as we see how things start to fall into place.
So on that piece, Jeff, when I wrote the note, Sullivan's come back to me VFR saying...
Who's Sullivan? Andrew Sullivan. not Andrew Sullivan. What's his name? Is it... And the He's Biden's guy right now. Hold on. Jake Sullivan is his name. So here, you'll recognize him. This guy, that's Jake Sullivan. So he's been Biden's right-hand man ever since Biden was vice president. So that's who they're talking about when they say Sullivan. Oh, don't want to jump there. We're going to get there in a moment. All right. So basically, this is in 2014, and Sullivan's still Biden's right-hand man as vice president. So Victoria Nuland says that she gets in touch with Jake Sullivan, and Jake Sullivan says that Biden is willing to be the midwife. Biden is willing to come in and midwife this coup d'etat. That's what they say.
If we move fast. So let me work on Klitschko. And if you can just keep, I think we want to try to get somebody with an international personality to come out here and help to midwife this thing. And then the other issue is some kind of outreach to Yanukovych, but we probably regroup on that tomorrow as we see how things start to fall into place.
So on that piece, Jeff, when I wrote the note, Sullivan's come back to me, VFR, saying you need Biden, and I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
Okay, great.
So Biden's willing. So, and as Biden says in the Council on Foreign Relations meeting, I got Ukraine. So this is how Biden gets Ukraine. And then he comes in with his son and they loot the place. So the Nazis were in charge of the new government. They put the Nazis in charge, all right? So we put the Nazis in charge. Victoria Nuland put the Nazis in charge. So the Nazis were in charge of the interim government before they had elections. So we're still asking the question, did Russia invade Crimea? And again, Russia has a naval base down here in Sevastopol, which they've had since the late 18th century. So there weren't only Nazis that were inside the government. There were Nazis that had taken part in the Euromaidan protests and in the violence there in Kiev. One of those groups is C-14 or S-14 or Snitch. Here, a Ukrainian national group founded in 2010 and 2018, gained notoriety for its violent attacks on Romani camps. Gained notoriety for its involvement in violent attacks on Romani camps. S-14's links to the Secret Service of Ukraine were also revealed in 2019. In 2020, the group disbanded and was succeeded by a new organization, the Foundation for the Future. So they were well involved in the coup history. S-14, C-14 was founded in 2010 as the youth wing of the ultra-nationalist political party Svoboda. So this goes back to Tiny Book's political party, this Nazi group. So they were Nazis. So these were the ground warriors, okay? Groups like this, and there were many of these groups. So you got C-14. You have the Sich battalion, also associated with Svoboda Nazi groups. You had the Azov battalion or Azov brigade that played a very prominent role in what was going there on there in Kiev during the coup. It was founded, look, Azov Battalion right here. It was founded in May 2014. So this is after the coup took place. But this regiment was founded, so for a reason. So why was this regiment founded in May of 2014 if the coup had already happened? I'm going to explain that to you. Because we're asking the question, who are the freedom fighters in Ukraine? Who are the freedom fighters in Ukraine, people? That's what we're asking the question. It's a little bit of video about the guy who created the Azov Battalion.
Plans in Ukraine are ambitious.
Сьогодні ми відпочиваємо. Але навіть відпочиваючи, ми пропагуємо наші нові українські цінності. Бути сильними і сміливими. Бути єдиними.
What worries officials in the West is Azov's recruitment strategy. It's tried hard to build friendships with far-right groups around the world, especially in the US and Europe. During my visit in 2019, I spent a day at one of the biggest recruitment events in Azov's history. Thousands of people showed up for a day of fighting sports and blatant propaganda. There were neo-Nazi symbols, tattoos, and posters all over the place.
Svoboda, you saw the Svoboda.
And many in the crowd seemed pretty receptive to Azov's far-right ideology.
These are the guys. These are the guys that when the United States government in 2014 says neo-Nazis, Ukraine neo-Nazis won't get U.S. money, that we won't fund these guys is what Congress said. They changed it in 2016 just before Donald Trump is sworn in. Actually, in 2017, just a week before Donald Trump was sworn in, they changed this policy. But they understood that these neo-Nazis were there. The neo-Nazis were heading the interim government. And the reason the Azov Brigade and groups like this, this is the most important group that you need to understand, this group right here, Right Sector. Here, let me show you a little clip about who Right Sector
is. A group calling itself the Right Sector is perhaps the largest. Its members can be seen marching around Kiev in columns of about...
There's many of these groups where Right Sector is the largest. You have to understand that.
A group calling itself the Right Sector is perhaps the largest. Its members can be seen marching around Kiev in columns of about a dozen. Mostly they carry baseball bats. Sometimes they carry guns. We met these men posing for pictures outside the burnt-out remains of what was once their headquarters. I asked them about their political beliefs.
Nationalist, socialist themes are popular amongst us.
In some people, она есть проступает, как бы, ну, чтобы была единая нация. Но не у всех это не заложено в основе этой организации. Это у некоторых людей есть.
А у вас?
У меня лично есть.
В смысле? Объясните.
Ну, мне как бы нравится эта идея единой нации.
Угу.
Я хочу, чтобы нация была единая, чтобы один народ, одна страна, одна нация.
А это подразумевается что? Что...
So, if you can't read that, he's saying that we basically want to be one country. You know, there's a lot of neo-Nazi philosophies within our group. Not everybody believes in those philosophies, but everybody believes that we should be one country, nationalist.
Ну, как бы, чтобы чистая нация. Ну, не то, что там, как бы у Гитлера как было.
Not like under Hitler.
Свое вроде немножко, ну, маленько, но было, чтобы своя нация.
What about the East, I asked? What about Crimea, where many Ukrainians feel close historical ties to Russia?
So he's asking these people from, this is the BBC report, and he's asking these people from right sector, what about the East? What about Crimea? What about people? This is right after the coup had taken place, and these Nazis are there brandishing weapons. They're happy to take pictures. They got Yanukovych to flee. They've won. They feel successful. So they're here talking to this BBC reporter, and he's saying that we're nationalists, we want one nation. And he's saying, what about these people? Hold on. So it's like I was explaining to you that the coup was taking place here in Kiev. And then the people in Odessa, I've already showed you in the last podcast that there were people in Odessa did not agree with the coup. They identified with Russia. He's asking, what about Crimea too? What about these people over here in Donbass region? Most of the people who Soros had brought in to stage the coup came from the West. These people are more aligned with the EU. They're more aligned with the West, and they're very anti people in the East. That's something that you got to understand, is that not everybody in Ukraine gets along, because there's all these Russian speakers over here identify with Russia, and then all these people, these Nazis in the West who hate these Russians. They have hate for them. I'm going to show you that here in a moment, or not in this podcast. We'll probably get into that in the next podcast, because I can see that I'm not going to have time. But I'm going to show you that these people have hate for these people, these Russian speakers. And you're going to see it here in this clip. So that's what this guy is asking him about here. What about the people in Crimea? What about these Russian speakers who identify with Russia and who do not support this coup? And take a look, listen to what this Nazi from right sector says.
They feel close historical ties to Russia.
Кому нравится Россия, пусть едут в Россию. Украина только для украинцев.
Those who like, he says, those who like Russia can go to Russia. Ukraine is for Ukrainians. That's what he says. Those who like Russia can go to Russia.
Ukrainians feel close historical ties to Russia.
Кто кому свое вроде немножко, ну маленько, но было чтобы своя нация.
What about the East? I asked. What about Crimea, where many Ukrainians feel close historical ties to Russia?
This BBC reporter, just in asking this question, lets you know that many Ukrainians feel historical ties to Russia, that the population of people here in Ukraine, I mean, here in Crimea, feel a historical ties to Russia, that there's more people in Crimea. This is just by his question, and I'm going to prove to you without a shadow of a doubt that what I'm telling you is true, that the majority of the people who live in Crimea identify more with Russia and did not support the coup d'etat.
About Crimea, where many Ukrainians feel close historical ties to Russia.
Хто кому нравиться Росія, пусть їде в Росію. Україна буде тільки для українців.
So that's basically what he says. He says, let them go to Russia if they want to be with Russia. Ukraine is for Ukrainians. And that's important because what you got to understand is that after the coup d'etat, and that's what we'll get into in the next podcast, that after the coup d'etat, the Nazis, the right sector, the Azov battalion, the C-14 and other Nazi groups, they spill out of the West, spill out of Kiev, and they have to get these guys in Odessa, Crimea, and the Donbass, they have to get them to comply, because if they don't comply and they put up a fight and don't go along with the new government, then there's going to be major problems. You're not going to be able to have elections. You're not going to be able to legitimize the new government if these people don't get in line. So these Nazis started coming down into Odessa, into Crimea, into Donbass, and intimidating these people. And the Nazis that took over the government in Kiev, they started passing laws to intimidate and persecute these Russian-speaking people that lived in these areas. I'm going to show you exactly what these people did. So I'm asking the question, who are the freedom fighters? The people in Donbass, as a reaction to the coup d'etat that had taken place, they declared their independence. Who are the freedom fighters? The people who declared their independence because of a coup d'etat that takes place in their capital. And then the Nazis call these people separatists and they go to war with them. I'm going to play, we'll pick this up in the next podcast. I'm going to play a little bit of these clips. I want to show you what took place in Odessa right after the coup. We watched this clip in the last podcast, but I have a few more that I want you to see.
This message here sums up what many people in the south and east of Ukraine really feel. They're saying, look, we are for a customs union. And what that means is that they want closer economic integration with their giant neighbour, Russia. At least one newly formed pressure group has sprung up in Odessa, calling for a referendum on a union. Organisers say they've collected more than 20,000 signatures.
So this is happening in Odessa. They're collecting signatures. They want a referendum. They want to vote on. What is democracy, people? They're telling you that you're supporting a democracy in Ukraine. They just staged the coup. These people are gathering signatures down in Odessa so they can have a referendum, exactly like the referendum that was passed in Crimea. Crimeans vote overwhelmingly to secede from Ukraine and join Russia. This was their reaction to the coup because most people in Crimea identified with Russia. This is democracy, people. Russia didn't invade Crimea. Crimea voted to secede from Russia, just like the people in the east, like in the Donbass region that declared their independence. Crimea wanted their independence after the coup. Odessa wanted their independence after the coup. All these people, when they saw what happened in their capital city in Kiev, they all moved to separate. These are the freedom fighters in Odessa, in Crimea, in Donbass. Those are the freedom fighters, people. Take a look at this. This is some clashes that took place in Odessa after the coup with the Nazis and the people who supported the new government and people who didn't support the new government. This is happening down in Odessa. Why don't you listen to this clip? This woman talking, she's in Odessa. Why don't you listen to some of this, what these people say?
I can't sit at home calmly and listen to what's going on here. They just used the opportunity where there were few people left in Odessa, people who went outside for holidays. They use this opportunity to get people inside the building and burn them alive. I can't keep calm about this.
All right, so she's talking about the Odessa massacre where Nazis burned people alive in Odessa. This is just some of the things that were done. We'll get back into this in the next podcast because I want you to understand who the freedom fighters are, people. And the freedom fighters are not who they tell you they are. And I agree with Mitt Romney. We should be supporting the freedom fighters, but we need to be truthful about who the freedom fighters are. I'm going to go more into this on Monday. I have to get into this, people. I have to do this. I hope you're enjoying it. Have a great weekend, and I'll see you guys on Monday.